Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am your host, Ian Shin. Today on our podcast, we have Lan Kurashige speaking about his book, Two Faces of Exclusion, The Untold Story of Anti-Asian Racism in the United States, published in 2016 by the University of North Carolina Press. Lan Kurashige is professor of history and spatial sciences at the University of Southern California, where his research focuses on Asian American history, the Japanese American experience, ethnic identity politics, internment studies, and comparative ethnicity. He is the author and editor of four other books in addition to Two Faces. In our conversation, Lan takes us through the twists and turns of the historical debates over the exclusion and restriction of Asian immigration to the United States. I also enjoyed speaking with Lan about some of the methodological changes in the field of Asian American history, especially the possibilities of quantitative and digital history. I hope you enjoy this interview. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ian Shin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we're talking to Lan Kurashige about his book, Two Faces of Exclusion, The Untold History of Anti-Asian Racism in the United States, published in 2016 by the University of North Carolina Press. Lan is professor of history and spatial sciences at the University of Southern California. Lan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself, Lan.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a historian at USC in LA, and I grew up in LA and went to undergrad Santa Barbara, and I discovered that I loved history, and I especially love my own personal history. I love learning about, especially Japanese American history and the internment camps. This is a history that was denied to me, or I didn't know anything about. And so I was quite angry and bitter when I learned about the internment. So that propelled me on to graduate school in Wisconsin. Wisconsin was really, you know, it was the first time I was away from the West Coast. And so that was really eye-opening to me. And it kind of perpetuated this anger I had about minority issues and feeling marginalized and neglected and the racism you experience. So that, I think, explains a lot of my motivation for my first book, which was on Japanese American, the construction of Japanese American ethnicity.
And so have you found your work sort of focused on the West Coast mainly, the Midwest, or how do you think about sort of, given that you grew up, you said, in LA and also did your graduate work in Wisconsin, how do you think about the sort of geographic focus that you take in your work?
Well, I think it's evolved and changed, and certainly it's been about, you know, learning about new places. I mean, growing up, even though LA is a very big city, you know, it's still, I think, like any place, it's still very regional in focus. At least that's how I grew up. I knew a lot about LA, but didn't know much about other parts of California or the country. And so my whole experience has been one of sort of broadening my circle of familiarity. And so the Midwest was really useful for that. Before that, I was in D.C. working on Capitol Hill. And then I think since grad school, it's only been about internationalizing. And so it's been the sort of evolution of a kind of regional to a global mentality.
It's interesting you say that, because I think in some ways it tracks with some of the trends and changes we see in the field of Asian American history, especially the internationalizing and the transnationalizing of that field. I'm curious, too, about the fact that you worked in Washington, D.C., which, as our listeners will get a sense of when we start to talk about the book, when it comes to roll call votes and counting votes and whatnot, you know, perhaps there's a connection there that I didn't realize. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you did in Washington and perhaps how that might have influenced the way that you think about the way that you do history now?
Well, I think work is probably not the right term. I was interning. So this was after I graduated, but it was still part of a kind of college internship program in D.C. But it did, in terms of getting me out of California, it really exposed me to a not just the D.C. or East Coast area, but a kind of national focus. And it exposed me to politics on the Hill. And so I was privy to, this is before internment, the redress legislation passed in 1988. And so I was privy to some meetings with Bob Matsui, and I worked for Norm Mineta, or interned for Norm Mineta's office. And so, you know, I could really get a sense of how policy was being made, and really, you know, interesting policy to me in terms of redress.
Right, and listeners will find it interesting later on that Congressman Mineta, who later on is Secretary of Transportation under President George W. Bush, does show up in Chapter 8, and you do talk about that history of the redress movement, which we'll get to later. But for now, I wonder if you can maybe tell us a little bit about how you came to write Two Faces of Exclusion, which is, I believe, your second monograph, although you've written or edited five books total as of today, as of 2018, right?
But I guess that's right. I'm not really counting. But in terms of the books, the single author books that I've written, there are two. And I think to understand the origins of Two Faces, you know, I need to start briefly with that first book, which was my dissertation, which is called Japanese American Celebration and Conflict. And that's a study of, like I said, ethnic identity construction, but it's through a festival in Los Angeles called Nisei Week Festival, focusing on Little Tokyo and Japanese Americans. And that was my dissertation, my first book, as I said. And that was all about an internal history of the Japanese American community in Los Angeles. And I was interested in the diversity of voices and perspectives, and how the construction of that identity was about silencing many of these alternative voices, oftentimes coming from communists or outsiders, other types of outsiders, younger generations. And then during the war, nationalists for Japan, et cetera. So there's incredible diversity, which I knew growing up in Los Angeles, but didn't see it represented in the literature so much. I saw it all flattened as, here's the Japanese American perspectives, or here are the different generational changes. But I didn't see all of the diversity that I saw growing up. And so that led to that book. But that book just focused on one group, on Japanese Americans. And it really assumed that all whites were hostile, racist, or indifferent, not seeking to, you know, be non-racist or beneficial to Japanese Americans. And in the second book, I learned that whites were not all racist. And so that was kind of the initial motivation to this. I was studying this guy, Chester Rowell, if you read the book, he becomes a kind of central figure to the book, although there are many characters in the book. And he's a guy who was incredibly racist toward the Japanese in the early 20th century, and then changes. He morphs in the 20s to becoming an incredible advocate for the Japanese and for other civil rights issues of the day. And so that really intrigued me. And that was the beginning of the Two Faces book. It's like, who else? Who among these other whites who were assumed to be only racist switched or were more complicated in terms of their views of Asians, not just Japanese, but other Asians? And so I started with Rao, and I just started looking to see, going back in time to the 1850s and ahead in time to the 1950s, you know, who else was like that? And I discovered a lot of people, or a lot more than I had assumed that there were. And they weren't just anybody. They weren't just sort of somebody on the street, but these were presidents. They were, you know, leaders of business. They were people like Chester Rowe, who were progressive leaders in California and the editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. And so I thought, wow, there's a real story here of these sort of more egalitarian whites, or at least more sympathetic or less discriminatory whites when it came to Asian American political issues. Then I faced a kind of, you know, a situation where I had to think about, okay, do I write a book just on them? And that's where my initial inclination was. But then when I started putting together their story, I realized, well, I can't really explain their story without connecting it with all of the whites who were racist. And there's a lot of those too. And so, but that's what the literature focuses on, as you know. And so I thought, well, there's a, I have to look at both sides, and thus the two faces or the debate over exclusion or internment or whatever the anti-Asian issue was. And so thus the origin of the book about two faces of exclusion.
Yeah, and I think one of the sort of key central features of the book, which hopefully will intrigue and entice our listeners, is that we have sort of, in some sense, lost the kind of nuance, right, of the exclusion debate and the anti-Asian racism in the United States. Your book does a wonderful job of restoring that nuance to this history. And that can be sometimes challenging to navigate, especially as we get into what we'll talk about in the eighth chapter, you know, where we want to sort of recognize both the historical, very clearly sort of racist origins of the history, but also sort of give credit to and recognize the egalitarianism that also fueled the anti-racist activism and policies that we do see from the mid-19th century to today. But I don't want to jump ahead too far ahead because I do actually have some other questions about the overall sort of structure of the book. And even before we sort of get to that, one of the things that, you know, as I started reading the book, I think, and anyone else who does, will be very struck by is the sort of jacket illustration you've chosen for Two Faces, which I did a little reading about, and it's a print by Roger Shimamura, and the title of the print is Shimamura Crossing the Delaware. It's a very sort of thought-provoking illustration. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the image and why you chose it to be the cover of Two Faces.
Yeah, I have been struck, as you were, by Roger's art. And I was surprised to learn from my aunt that she had known him, because they all grew up in Seattle together and attended the University of Washington. And so she knew him there. And I think my uncle knew him even better, because there was some personal connection to one of his relatives. So I like that, but that's not why I chose the print. Or it just struck me. If you know Roger's art, he puts his face in a lot of it. And he does it with an Asian American consciousness. He puts his face where a iconic white face will be, in this case, George Washington crossing the Delaware. And it really challenges the viewer to think about, wow, why, you know, it looks strange. It looks funny, you know, either funny ha-ha or funny just odd and strange. But then it challenges the reader to think about why. You know, why is it that, you know, what are our racial assumptions about whiteness or about Asianness, you know, that make that unusual and peculiar? And I thought that, you know, that would be perfect. And since, you know, this is a historical depiction, I thought it would be really great for this book. And he generously, you know, allowed me to use it.
Yeah, it's a really fantastic sort of image to represent the story of the book, and listeners who find a chance to look up this print will see that you know, in fact, the Roger's face, the artist's face, is takes the place of George Washington, but all the men that he rows across the Delaware with have been replaced or substituted with Japanese samurai.
Right.
And the Delaware I read in the National Portrait Gallery that the Delaware has been supplanted with the San Francisco Bay, and that you can in fact see Angel Island and the distance. So it's a really great image to kick off the story. And in fact, the kind of nautical theme ties in really nicely with one of the major kind of motifs that you bring to this history, which is this idea of a perfect storm narrative. And you also organize the book chronologically, but with this storm motif. And we'll talk about some of the chapter titles, which are so wonderful. But I want to start with this idea of a perfect storm narrative, which you talk about in the history of anti-Asian racism in the United States. What do you mean by a perfect storm narrative?
Yeah, that was important to me. And it was just a kind of accident that the artwork, you know, picked up on that. I think my main point, or that what drew me to that idea and apply that idea to this narrative, is that I think so often the assumption is that anti-Asian racism was inevitable. You know, there's no history. I mean, there's a history to, you know, how it was expressed and who got hurt and how bad it was. Kind of, it was sort of bad there, then got really bad, you know. But I think the perfect storm sort of metaphor, to me, allowed me to show the historicity of anti-Asian racism, and that, you know, it's not just a question of always bad and then worse, but it's a question of contingency, that things came together at certain moments of time in my story in the late 19th century, and that there's a lot of unrelated sort of historical phenomenon that just converged to create these conditions in which exclusion was possible. And so that implies that exclusion wasn't possible from the 1850s till the early 1880s till 1882, with Chinese exclusion or Chinese restriction. And indeed it wasn't in terms of a national policy of exclusion. And I think a lot of the scholarship implies or outright states that that whole period from the 1850s to the 80s was sort of racism, and it was inevitable that it was going to happen at some point.
And I think one of the things that one of the questions that you sort of cite as a prompt is you know, I think Gordon Chang, who wrote or posed the question, you know, why did exclusion take so long?
Right.
And that's one of the ways in which we might think about how there are different, as you write, vulnerabilities that need to sort of come together in order to enable exclusionists to win the victories that they seek over a 140-year period, and then eventually lose out to egalitarians, but that it's constantly flowing back and forth between the two of them. So let's dive into the book. And again, I'm just going to tell listeners, you know, that the chapters titles, because they tie in so beautifully to this perfect storm narrative. So let's start with chapter one, which is entitled "Before the Storm: Race for Commercial Empire, 1846 to 1876." I sometimes wondered if reading that title, "race," you meant both in the sense of competition, but also in the sense that we often understand it today as a marker of social difference. In this chapter, in the first chapter, you introduce us to the two basic camps that are going to take sides on the question of Asian migration and settlement in the United States throughout the rest of the book. And those are the exclusionists and the egalitarians. And so here we meet people like William Speer, Charles Sumner, John Conness. Some of these names, for example, Sumner, will be more familiar to listeners than others, perhaps, like William Speer and John Conness. So perhaps you can start off by telling us a little bit about, in the context of the mid-19th century, what do the exclusionist and egalitarian camps look like? How are they broken down?
Okay, but I think before I get into chapter one, one part of the book that I think a lot of your listeners and historians in general are curious about is the term you've been using without sort of commenting on it, and that is egalitarian. Maybe it struck you as odd. It strikes a lot of people as odd. And I have to say, I thought really deeply and long about whether to use that term egalitarian, because in these days it means somebody who's, you know, just perfect in a way, right? Who's beyond any kind of racial prejudice or any sort of bias at all, and has a sort of, you know, wonderful understanding of equality across everybody, you know, not just race, but class, gender, sexual, whatever. To be egalitarian is sort of like to be incredibly the most noble person. You know, maybe the Dalai Lama is egalitarian today or something. It's kind of an ideal form where very few people reach. And the people I'm talking about, like the ones you mentioned, whether it's Speer or Conness, or who I'd want to focus on in chapter one is William Seward, because he's really the main character in that chapter, or Anson Burlingame. They were hardly perfect people, you know, when it came to race or class or sexuality or gender, any of those things. And so a lot of my critics will say, well, why even use the word egalitarian? You know, they were all still had racial biases. They were men, white men in the 19th century, right? And so I totally concede that. And that's absolutely true. But I think I want to, by egalitarian, I want to use a historically specific term of what does egalitarianism mean in the 19th century versus the early 20th century, and how that idea changes with the changes in this whole exclusion debate that I talk about. But also part of it was I wanted to shed light on what do we mean by exclusionists? Because that's the other side. That's the two faces, right? That's the other face. And I think so often we accept an assumption that exclusionist just means they're racist, right? And in many ways, to a certain extent, everyone, all whites in America were exclusionists or were biased in some ways. And I want to show how that term is inadequate as well. I mean, there's no perfect term here, but I think exclusionist is not historically specific. It has a sort of essentialist understandings or assumptions about, in this case, whites, you know, they're all this way, et cetera. And I think a lot of literature picks up on those types of essentialist assumptions. And so I thought, well, why not use egalitarian as an imperfect term? Because exclusionist is just as imperfect. But to make sure as best I can in the introduction and throughout to show that what I mean by exclusionist and what I mean by egalitarian. That's why in the introduction there is a lot of sort of ink spilled about what I mean by egalitarian. And I don't know if people are going to agree with me in terms of how I'm using it, but you know, at least I do try to explain that term with nuance. Okay, and so now on chapter one, and so I really think that, as I said, William Seward is the main character here. It starts with him, you know, in terms of a kind of anecdote about him and how you mentioned Gordon Chang. Both Gordon and I talk about people like Seward and others who had this incredible, you know, global vision or Pacific vision in the 1840s and even earlier. Even Jefferson and so forth saw Asia, China in particular, as a means for developing the U.S. economically to surpass Britain, which was, you know, at the time in the late 17th century, early 18th century, was by far the superior power economically, militarily, everything to the U.S., right? And so the whole goal was to catch up, and the U.S. was very much a third world or third rate power at the time. And so they saw China as their way to catch up economically. And so they had this vision of a commercial empire, not a military empire, but a commercial empire. And so the question really was, how do we manifest that? How do we create these types of trade routes to China and to bring all of those riches from China to, you know, products and so forth to the U.S.? And, you know, at first, the U.S. is the 13 states or colonies that became states, right? First, you had to get to the Pacific coast, right? And so this chapter is all about how does the U.S. get to the Pacific coast and how does that whole dream of Asia, you know, step by step, come to be more of a reality. And so it starts with Seward's sort of grandiose visions of, at one point, you know, in the 1840s, when he's a senator, U.S. senator from New York, you know, his visions, his dreams really about this trans-Pacific sort of connection. And key to those dreams, he was very aware of, was immigration, because there were no people in the West, you know, in terms of large numbers of workers who can really develop, who can build the bridges and the harbors and man the factories, et cetera, that you needed, that you would see on the East Coast with the Irish and the Germans and all of the immigrants flooding into the country in the 1840s and 50s. So he had these, you know, these dreams, but he had these, a key part of it was Chinese immigration. And he had no problems with millions of Chinese coming in because he put development and commercial empire and surpassing Britain, or at least competing with Britain, ahead of any notion of racial difference. In fact, he thought, you know, the Chinese were just as capable. They were just, you know, developmentally behind because of the, you know, particularities of Asian history. But he didn't think racially they were inferior at all. So it starts with that vision. And then the chapter ends with Seward going on a trip after Seward becomes Lincoln's Secretary of State, you know, during the Civil War, Lincoln administration. And his whole, you know, he's there at the time when the Republicans create the Transcontinental Railroad, the Congress passes legislation to pay for the Transcontinental Railroad. That's in some ways, you know, he claims that. That's all part of this sort of filling out the vision of this commercial empire of the Pacific. You know, he's mostly known, you know, by people today for, you know, buying Alaska, Seward's Folly, right? There's Seward, Alaska. But that's, again, you know, whether it's folly or not, that was all part of the vision of getting to the West Coast and creating these, you know, the fur trade but also whaling was really big. And so Alaska was a very commercially important place for Pacific economic, you know, commercial empire. So Seward is a key person. And at the end of the chapter, after he retires from Secretary of State and from politics, towards the end of his life, he goes on a tour and he goes to Asia and he takes the Transcontinental Railroad across, you know, to San Francisco, stays in San Francisco and takes the Pacific Steamship, the company line that, well, you know, he was Secretary of State when he was in Congress, the U.S., when he was Secretary of State, the U.S. Congress creates a contract with the Pacific Mail Steamship Company in San Francisco, a semi-private company. And then they are the key American commercial shipping link to China and Japan. And so he travels on that ship and he sees all of the merchandise going from America to China. He sees Chinese immigrants going home. He sees missionaries going abroad to Asia, military Asiatic squadron, the U.S. Navy, you know, to Asia. And this is all, to some extent, he had a hand in all of this coming to be by the early 1870s. But it was just a pipe dream in the 1840s. So that's what this chapter is really about. And at the core of this is, as I said, was this notion of immigration, right? And that Chinese immigration was completely not just okay, it was welcomed. You know, it was welcomed by the U.S. So there's a very important treaty between the U.S. and China called the Burlingame Treaty, 1868. And Seward is Secretary of State at the time, and he's very close with Anson Burlingame, who's American, who is representing China, though. He used to be a House of Representatives from Massachusetts, used to be a congressman from Massachusetts, who's a radical Republican, sympathetic, you know, same with Seward. And so he had that same vision of commercial empire. And so in that treaty, what's really key about the Burlingame Treaty was it allows Chinese immigration to the U.S. on the same terms as any immigrants coming to the U.S. And it's a very liberal treaty when it comes to U.S.-Chinese relations, especially when it comes to Chinese immigration. So that's all, that's the constant theme about the exclusion debate, is the larger context of commercial empire, but how Chinese immigration was open and welcome.
That brings us beautifully to actually the second chapter then, which we begin to see, as the title suggests, the first downpour about Chinese immigrants and Gilded Age politics from 1876 to 1882. Folks who are familiar with U.S. history will obviously pick up on the connections to the end of Reconstruction and the enactment of the Chinese Exclusion Act. This chapter for me was really exciting because it proposed a new approach of looking at debates over Chinese exclusion in the 1870s and 1880s, in particular by taking stock of what you call the the totality of roll call voting in Congress. And we've already alluded earlier to the sort of revision that you're trying to make in terms of understanding all the different priorities that are being sort of played up and debated around the nation during this period. What does this vote counting, especially when we break it down by region, as you do in Chapter 2, what does that vote counting tell us that's new about why Chinese exclusion happens in the 1870s and 1880s?
Yeah, there's a lot of work written over the years on Chinese exclusion, on the 1882 Act. And we can debate to whether to call it exclusion or restriction. It's really restriction. It's not total ban. But none of them really relied upon roll call votes, you know, as a crucial source. Some might mention a roll call vote here or there. And just for your listeners, I wasn't always familiar with this. A roll call vote is a vote taken in Congress about a particular, you know, measure. It could be as simple as, should we adjourn right now or later on, or should we vote before we adjourn, et cetera, or it could be a major legislation. Usually all that's required is that somebody raises their hand and says, I'd like a roll call vote taken on this measure. And most of them, I would say about, it depends on the Congress, but maybe about half of them get roll call votes, maybe less than half of them. And so roll call votes are not every vote does not get a roll call vote. And all the roll call vote is just, it just tells you who voted for what. You know, there were, I don't know, 10 votes for no and, you know, 150 votes for yes, and how each individual member voted. So there were some analysts who would look at some of these roll call votes on Chinese exclusion or issues related to it, and then talk about, oh, this person voted, or this state voted this way, or this region voted this way. But nobody really incorporated that into a systematic analysis. And there were many roll call votes involving Chinese issues or issues of Chinese exclusion. Like I said, it could be as simple as to adjourn and so forth. So I discovered that there's a database available of roll call votes. In fact, I knew about this for other factors, and this wasn't so much from working for Norm on the Hill, but this was in graduate school of Wisconsin, where one of my mentors was Alan Bogue, who was a well-known Western historian, but he was also well-known as a political historian of the U.S., who was involved in cleometrics, involved in quantitative history. And he was a founder of ICPSR, which is this big clearinghouse of quantitative data in the social sciences at the University of Michigan, which is still, you know, going very strong, but started in the 60s. And one of the first things they did was they compiled all these quantitative votes from the congressional record, and they put them into database forms where you can use them through statistical packages. So I learned about that in graduate school. I didn't really think about it in terms of Asian American issues. I just kind of filed it away. But then, you know, in coming in doing this project, it just came back. And I thought, oh, well, I should look at that database. And sure enough, I found a lot of votes on the Chinese. So that's the kind of a key part of the data source for this chapter, is thinking about Chinese exclusion through these roll call votes. But then starting there, but then, you know, from there, really thinking about the context in which these votes were taking. And so first, I had to connect it to the first chapter, which I just talked about. So I had to continue those themes. And in fact, the roll call votes go back to that first chapter as well, because I looked at roll call votes about creating, you know, transportation networks to the West, funding the Pacific Mail Steamship Company, you know, which failed until the Republicans got control of the government during the Civil War, when the South left and all the Democrats, you know, were at a disadvantage. And so there really is a kind of thread of looking at the roll call votes to see what I can say about this larger context of Pacific commercial empire, because that's how I see Chinese immigration issues. It's all tied to the vision of Pacific commercial empire.
You also do some really interesting counts of terms and keywords that appear in select newspapers using the San Francisco Chronicle and what you categorize as egalitarian newspapers, including the New York Times, the New York Tribune, the Hartford Courant. You compare the appearance of different words like coolie, labor, union, importation, and monopoly in the San Francisco Chronicle versus rights, trade, goods, Republican, and treaty in egalitarian newspapers. I think, you know, folks who will read this book will sort of, again, see the quantitative history and the methodology that's, I think, distinctive compared to, it seems to me, the trend to focus more on cultural studies or cultural dimensions of Asian American history recently. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit about how you see the broader methodological shifts and or trends within our field and what you hope to see in terms of engagement with things like these kinds of databases when it comes to the political history of exclusion. I think one of the things that we might even touch on, jumping ahead a little bit, is again your work on Chapter 5, when you look at the vote breakdowns for Proposition 1, which is, we'll talk about a little bit, an expansion of an alien land law in California, and the ways in which you are able to use geographic distribution, and perhaps you can, this is where we might talk about your role as a professor of spatial sciences as well, to incorporate some of that data into the way that we do Asian American history. So taking all of that in view, a very long-winded question, how do you think about the methodological changes in Asian American history overall?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I really like to talk about methodology. And even in my first book, I've always had quantitative data in my study. That first book, as I said, was about the construction of Japanese American identity, but it was focused on a festival. So there was a kind of overlay of anthropology and cultural studies in terms of how do you analyze a festival, right? Or meanings of race and ethnicity, identity within a festival. But there was always the social history spine of the census, of data, of, you know, counting, you know, who's and trying to connect sociologically, who's most likely to have this discourse on identity as opposed to this discourse on identity. Those were all sort of, in some ways, I'm really, as a social historian, I'm really sort of interested in these type of sociological questions. So I continue that in this book. When it comes to methodology, I'm very inclusionist. I don't like to throw anything out. So, you know, part of me was drawn, trained as in social history. I took the cultural turn. I was in grad school at the time when, you know, Foucault and Derrida and all the cultural studies movement happened. And I took courses in cultural studies and anthropology. I loved it. You know, I loved all that stuff. And so I very much, and Michael Omi and Howard Wynand's book on racial formation, so taking the cultural turn to race theory and racial, you know, studies, that's a huge part of that first book. But at the same time, I'm just, I don't want to throw anything out. I think the temptation is that, okay, now we do discourse and that means all the quantitative stuff is no longer. I just like to keep it all in and just mash it all together, because I just think any source that you can find, especially, you know, in a field like Asian American history, where there's not a lot of sources all the time, you know, why throw anything out? I like to sort of incorporate all of it, you know, in a way that's thoughtful, to think about, okay, well, you have to handle this source a little bit differently than this kind of source. But then, you know, once you have those precautions, how do you merge them together in a narrative? What can they tell you? What piece of the story can they provide? So I continue that, as you mentioned, in this book, with the looking at, and these days with the, you know, the digitization of everything, like newspapers, right? It's so easy to get the New York Times or the Tribune or the Chronicle, you know, all our universities subscribe to them, but I feel like they're more useful than just reading them, right? And so why not do something like that? Well, connect discourse. What's the discourse? What are the key terms used by these different regions, where the Chronicle represented the West Coast and the three other papers represent the East Coast? What discourse do they use? What key terms do they use? So rather than just reading that, you can also quantifiably count them. right? So easily, just put in search terms. So I thought this is a way of taking advantage of a technology that we use, you know, every day, but we don't always apply it to our analysis in this way. And what it showed was, when you mentioned those terms, was it confirmed, it added more evidence to the argument I was making that there were East and West Coast differences in how they viewed Chinese exclusion. And it depended on their political economy. You know, that in the East Coast, it was a center of the nation's business. The whole nation, the whole sort of finance and capital and maritime, you know, shipping and all that stuff was all in the Northeast. And so they saw the exclusion as an issue of treaty rights, as an issue of keeping the Burlingame Treaty, or at least if modifying it gently, you know, not getting rid of it, of keeping good ties with China. So consistent with the Seward vision, with the Burlingame constituency, I call it. Whereas in the West Coast, it was very different, right? It was all about labor rights. It was about, you know, equality for white working class people as opposed to the rich robber barons. And Chinese exclusion was seen as a wedge, right, against, you know, between them, their opportunity, a wedge between them and the white elite. And so they wanted to get rid of that wedge and create more equality. So I'm glad you asked about methodology.
Well, I think this brings us then after... considering some of the debates over Chinese restriction or exclusion, then to chapters 3 and 4. 3, 4, and 5 really work well, I think, as thinking about the shifting of the debate from Chinese issues to issues that touch on other Asian populations, Japanese being probably the biggest one, but also Filipinos as well. And chapter 3 really thinks about the way in which you are able to identify two key forces in the 1880s and 1890s that impact Asian restriction or Asian exclusion. First is the opposition to broader waves of immigration beyond those that are from Asia to include people from Eastern and Southern Europe. The second is the what you call the dawn of America's imperial age, which most people think about with the 1890s, with the annexation of Hawaii, and with the colonization of the Philippines. I wanted to focus in particular on that second part, on America's imperialism, because we've seen in other accounts the links between U.S. imperialism or U.S. foreign relations and immigration. I'm thinking in particular of Don Akbachi's work and others. But, you know, perhaps again, drawing back to the central argument of your book, what does U.S. imperialism do in terms of the cause of egalitarianism, as you've defined it?
Yeah, that's kind of surprises people. It surprised me perhaps when I researched it, because we usually just see the annexation of the Philippines as just another expression of anti-Asian racism, right? It's just consistent with all the exclusionism that's going on in the U.S., you know, at the same time, whether it's against the Chinese or the Japanese, and then later on, certainly against the Filipinos. And that's true. I mean, there's no denying that there's an incredible, I mean, Paul Kramer's book on the Philippines, you know, shows clearly about how all of the sort of the ideas of benevolent assimilation or of uplift had a racial dimension, right? There was this idea that we can uplift them, but it's going to take a long time. We don't know how long because they're so backward and they're so racially other, right? Yet at the same time, and I completely am convinced with all of that, but at the same time, when I bring it back to the study of two phases of exclusion, of two sides, the exclusion debate in the U.S., the colonists like McKinley or T.R. or Taft, who's the first, you know, U.S. official governing the Philippines and then becomes president, it's completely, you know, this benevolent assimilation, completely paternalistic and with racial tinges, of course, but they're on the side of non-discrimination. You know, they're on the egalitarian side of the exclusion debate, because how can you, on the one hand, promote Filipino uplift and encourage and allow, create a program in which elite Filipino students are coming to the U.S. to study at colleges to show what a noble mission the U.S. has or has been under, you know, is operating in the Philippines to uplift these savage, quote unquote, people. And at the same time, say, oh, we want to exclude them because they're inferior, right? And so there was a dissonance there. And so the colonialists tended to be almost always on the side of non-discrimination, on the egalitarian side. And so I see this dimension of imperialism as adding new players to this exclusion debate, supporting really the egalitarian side. And on the other side, people like Samuel Gompers, who's the head of the AFL, major labor union, is against imperialism. You know, doesn't support in many ways. He concedes in some ways, but in general, his stance is against imperialism. He's anti-imperialist. And one of the main factors is because by engaging in imperialism, the U.S. is required to allow these new subjects like Filipinos to enter the country. And so, you know, that supports the same players who were on the exclusionist side, you know, use imperialist or anti-imperialist arguments to buffer or support their cause. Did you hold on, Ian? You can edit this out, but my computer it shut down because I wasn't, you know, it did a sleep mode. Are you okay?
Yep, I can still hear you.
Good. So there was no funny pause or anything?
No, okay. Not at all.
Good. Okay. Give me another prompt. How can I continue with these three chapters?
Well, so I think the other issue that Gompers and his followers bring up is another concept that might be surprising to our listeners, which again, you know, you do such a wonderful job of reframing some of these familiar concepts and notions that we have about Asian exclusion to help us rethink this history. And I'm really referring to one of the central ideas in Chapter 4, the title of which is Rising Tide of Fear, White and Yellow Perils, 1904 to 1919. Folks may be very familiar with the idea of a yellow peril who are familiar with Asian American history, the idea of yellow hordes coming from Asia to take over the United States and contaminate its political, economic, and social life. But I think the idea of a white peril might be something that people are surprised to hear about. And this is a phrase that you borrow from Sidney Gulick, again, someone on the egalitarian side of the debate. So how does white peril surface or fears of white peril surface at the turn of the 20th century? And what do they have to do with the debate over racism and exclusion?
Yeah, that's a important point. And I think this has to do with expanding the scope. If you look beyond the U.S. for this narrative, if you look at sort of U.S.'s global reach, or maybe even the West, Europe's global reach, you know, to Asia, then you're drawn to people like Sidney Gulick, right, who's an American, but who's a missionary in Japan. And he becomes fluent in Japanese. He's there for many years. He really loves Japan in many ways. His mission, as maybe many of your listeners know, you know, it kind of fails, right? The U.S. does not, I mean, Japan does not become a major Christian country like, say, Korea does. But still, a lot of these missionaries really come to respect Japanese people and Japanese culture. And so they're the leaders, or they're a very important input into or influence in on the egalitarian side when Japan becomes the major subject of exclusion in the early 20th century. All the way up through the war, right, World War II. And so when you expand the narrative to include, you know, all of Asia, then you get these perspectives and you get these concerns about, hey, wait a minute, exclusion is so humiliating to whether it's China or in this case, Japan, that we need to not, you know, we need to not discriminate because it's screwing up not just our missionary, you know, our mission in East Asia, but it's screwing up our good political relations between the U.S. and Japan. right? The Japanese government is really humiliated and upset at any sort of mention of a kind of exclusion like that, which happened with the Chinese, because Japan at the time is an imperial power. It defeats China in the 1890s, and then defeats Russia in 1904, right? And its military, its navy in particular, is top-notch. Japan is developing in so many other ways, economically, culturally, you know, its cities, etc., is borrowing from the West, is in conversation with the West, sees itself very much as a world power. And Theodore Roosevelt, when he becomes president, very much acknowledges this, you know, very supportive of Japan and very impressed with its civilization and fearful in many ways of a potential war. And so these are new actors, you know, these international players like Gulick, and then even Gulick is in touch with the Japanese foreign ministry as well. And they're plotting, well, plotting is not the right word, but they're cooperating to oppose Japanese exclusion. And so that's the white peril, right, applied to the exclusion debate, is that actions, sort of arrogant, racist actions by white powers like the U.S. in Asia are a peril to some kind of Pacific cooperation, some kind of, you know, mutual development and anti-war, right, some kind of perpetuation of peace. And so the whites need to be very careful about being overtly racist. They can't do that because Japan is now a world power. They can't do that anymore and get away with it.
Right. And we, in fact, as you recount for us in the book, see some testimonies later on that the sort of formalization of Japanese restriction in 1924, you know, people testify that there is an impact in terms of the fallout, the political fallout in Japan, and the sort of decline of liberalism and the rise of a military government that, you know, led to World War II. That's sort of the explanation that a lot of people give about the negative effects of that white peril.
It's not the only factor, but it is
important to acknowledge.
Yeah, I mean, there's geopolitics too, but still, you know, that type of racism was corrosive.
Right, right. So I think what I want to do is maybe push us a little forward into that interwar period. I mentioned earlier about Chapter 5, when you look at issues of nationalism, internationalism, and Japanese exclusion between 1919 and 1924. In particular, I'll just note for listeners the analysis that you do. Again, looking at spatial data between Northern and Southern California, but also different neighborhoods in Los Angeles, around the issue of the alien land law, which was targeted against Japanese immigrants. That's a fascinating chapter that unfortunately we don't have as much time to tap into, because I want to get to the back half of the book. So I want to talk about Chapter 6, which is entitled Silver Lining, New Deals for Asian Americans, 1924 to 1941. Again, to really highlight a set of characters or actors in the egalitarian camp that listeners may not be quite as familiar with in this chapter. You look at the interwar reinvigoration of egalitarianism, but also explain why before World War II, where we really see that sort of great transformation, as you call it, you talk about how in this interwar period, despite this reinvigorated egalitarianism, it really has very little impact on anti-Asian policies. The group of new players in this period that folks may be interested in hearing about are the organizers of the Institute of Pacific Relations, the administrators of the Survey of Race Relations. So can you tell us a little bit about who is the IPR and what new approaches and perspectives do they bring to egalitarianism during the interwar period?
Sure. You did mention the data on Los Angeles voting precincts. I just want to mention this for a second, just how wonderful. This is another example of finding
Please do.
In this case, spatial data. Quantitative data that I spatialized through GIS software. But it was just such a lucky coincidence that voting precinct data is easy to find. You just get it from the state of California for 1920, in this case, 1920 general election. So I got that. And so I was able to, you know, recount all of the different over 700 voting precincts in Los Angeles and how they voted on this proposition, this alien land land law proposition to strengthen the alien land law against discriminating against Japanese landowning. But I found through looking from the city archives of Los Angeles, I was talking to the archivist, and there's a map of voting precincts in Los Angeles. And so it's a long story, but I was able through an engineer at the Spatial Sciences Institute on my campus to match that map, to create a GIS map of that, to digitize basically that map and to input, this is what GIS software allows you to do, input all of that precinct data into that map. So I can get spatially, I can see which areas of the city were voting for and against, and then to connect those areas of the city with different socioeconomic variables. Anyway, so it was just really fun to do that. So back to the 1930s. I think what I did in every one of these chapters was I know the literature, or I read the literature, and I've been teaching Asian American history for many years, so I know the literature pretty well. And I was just, as I was thinking about the literature through the data and through the evidence I was looking at in terms of the exclusion debate, there was a mismatch. There was a mismatch because the scholarship, almost all of it, tends to focus on the exclusionist side. So I kept asking the question, well, what's the egalitarian side doing, right? And what's the relationship between the two? And so I discovered all of this in the 1930s, egalitarian, those who were supporting Asians, who wanted to get a quota for Japan after they were excluded in 24, there were a number of fairly influential individuals and groups who said, okay, there's exclusion. Now let's try to amend that. Let's get a quota so there can be 100, 200 Japanese, just a token quota for the Japanese. And then the Japanese government will be happy and will prevent war. We'll have better peaceful relations. And so the Institute of Pacific Relations is a key part of that constituency, the egalitarian side, to push for that quota. And who they are were a non-governmental organization that began in 1925 in Hawaii as a result of or spurred on by the Japanese exclusion crisis to prevent war in the Pacific, to create a harmonious sort of situation for stability, for trade, for cultural understanding, all of that. And they were basically, it was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, who were consistently supporting these kinds of causes. The Carnegie Foundation was another one. Carnegie, for international peace, the Carnegie program was very big as well in promoting relations with Japan and directly opposing, or in some sort of kind of secretive ways as well, opposing discriminating or Asian exclusion, Japanese exclusion. And they're also funded by the YMCA. There was a lot of connection between there was a lot of Christian sort of spirit between among all of these. Rockefeller Foundation there was a real religious spirit to that as well. Carnegie supported Christian campaigns for peace, etc. And almost all of these. Gulick was a Christian minister, as I mentioned. He was very much the implementer and the organizer of a lot of this money from the Carnegie and Rockefeller foundations. And so what the IPR did was it invited every nation on the Pacific or had interest in the Pacific to send representatives to talk about important issues involving the Pacific. And in this case, the first one was Japanese exclusion. And so the U.S. government, U.S. sent representatives, not so much government people, but they were usually former government officials, like former secretaries of state, et cetera, leading intellectuals, academics, very prominent people. Japan sent representatives, excuse me, but there were a lot of people there. It starts in Hawaii. And then the IPR, and the IPR's sort of recommendations and the kind of discussions they have are all for peace, or all on the egalitarian side. I mean, I wouldn't say every single person, because Paul Scherenberg was there, who was a labor advocate, who opposed, you know, who was an exclusionist. And yet he was, because he would go to the IPR and be exposed to all this, he was more nuanced and complicated in his position, at least privately. And so there's sort of private stories about how he was being recruited, and he even agreed to be on the egalitarian side to promote this quota for Japanese immigrants. So that's a new player. They are tied to this. A lot of the same people are tied to a survey of race relations, which is a big Rockefeller-funded academic study headed by Robert Park, who was the leading sociologist of his day from the University of Chicago, at Stanford University. And Stanford is a bastion of egalitarianism, from its president, David Starr Jordan, early on, you know, from the turn of the century all the way up to the 1920s. He is a big friend of Japan and didn't want any kind of exclusion or humiliation of the Japanese. I take that back. It's a little bit more nuanced. He doesn't care about excluding the laborers, but he doesn't want complete exclusion. You know, he doesn't want his students who are coming from Japan, or he doesn't want intellectuals or the elite classes of Japan, which he knows Japan very well, excluded and humiliated. He wants peace as well between the U.S. and Japan. You know, the next president becomes the head of the IPR. And so Stanford has a real, you know, big role to play in this survey, and as well as in the IPR. And the survey, what its whole purpose was, and this was in many ways was planned originally by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. They wanted to fund a survey like this, but they don't get to it. And so it gets manifested in the 20s. And the whole purpose was to do serious academic research onto Asian immigration issues. Now, they call it survey of race relations, but that's sort of, all of the subjects were mostly about Chinese, Japanese, Indian, Filipino issues, all the way around the West Coast, all the way up to British Columbia. And it was Robert Park had said, his arguments, his conclusions are very supportive of an egalitarian position. There's really not a lot of exclusionists at all in that. And so there's a consistent, these new players, these survey race relations, and then many of the managers of that survey go on to the IPR, the direct connection in Hawaii. And then they continue to push for a quota until it becomes impossible to achieve because Japanese militarism in Manchuria starts ramping up, and then it just becomes politically impossible to try to soften Japanese exclusion. At the same time, the U.S. government and State Department are opposing Japanese expansionism in northern China. There are other new players in the 30s, too. Here's where the Filipinos come back in, because Filipino exclusion happens. A lot written about that in 1934 with the Tidings McDuffie Act. But there's a number of hearings and, before that time in which Filipino players are coming from the Philippines, you know, Manuel Rojas, et cetera, major political leaders of, let me back up a little bit, but 1916 and from there on, the Philippines colony is becoming, the U.S. is granting it more autonomy. It's still a colony. The U.S. still has the final word, but there is a legislature. There's a two-house, bicameral legislature, and the Filipinos are allowed to make their own laws. Now, of course, the Americans have the ultimate authority about whether to approve them, but there's still the sort of practicing democracy in works, which wasn't there earlier on in the colonial era. There's a representative in Congress, right, for the Philippines, like Hawaii had one, all the territories have one, the colonies have one. They were non-voting, but a lot of these officials, the non-voting representatives and the politicians, leading politicians from the Philippines, converge on the DC and they oppose Filipino exclusion vigorously. But there's this nuance to the debate, which is different from what happens with the Chinese or Indians or Japanese, and that is okay. They introduce this notion of independence. And, you know, they wouldn't always say this, but they're saying we oppose all of this racism against the representation of Filipinos in America or hordes of them coming in. But at the same time, if you grant us independence, we will kind of, you know, be okay with it. If you want to exclude us, that's okay. Well, it's not us because it's not the elites. You know, it's the workers who are mostly coming. But will take that in exchange for independence. And that's, in fact, I mean, it's not, I'm putting it simplistically, but that's, in fact, what happens with the Tidings McDuffie Act. It sets the U.S. or the Philippines on a 10-year timetable for independence. But at the same time, it starts exclusion right then, right away. And so Filipino exclusion happens 34 with the Tidings McDuffie Act. But there are these new players on the egalitarian side that we don't tend to think about. And the last one I'll say very briefly are labor activists. So before this time, Gompers and many, many other labor activists are clearly on the exclusionist side. But in the 30s is when you have the, you know, the emergence of the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which is a radical form of labor organizing. Communists are very influential in the CIO, but it's not all communists, who oppose the AFL and their strategy of labor, just looking at the craft and the, you know, the elite laborers, and not looking at all the unorganized workers, whether it's in agriculture or shipping or the docks or et cetera. And so the CIO is going after everybody, one big union, all the non-skilled workers with the skilled workers. And the AFL is just on the skilled workers. Now, part of that difference and clash between CIO and AFL is that the CIO supports the egalitarian side in the debate because they want to organize everyone. They don't want to exclude the Asian immigrants. They want to organize them in their union against the big business owners. AFL continues their exclusionist side. So these are all new players in the debate in the 1930s.
Well, then this brings us perfectly to Chapter 7, which sees all of these players, all of these new and old players together on both sides of the debate during World War II. Chapter 7 is entitled Winds of War, Internment, and the Great Transformation, 1941 to 1952. And the thing that's really interesting about this chapter for me is how you sort of bring the exclusionist and the egalitarian sides together for what both would consider probably their high point. On one hand, the exclusionists achieve sort of their greatest triumph, total exclusion of Japanese and Japanese Americans from the West Coast. But at the same time, it provides an opportunity for egalitarians to dismantle a lot of the exclusionist policies that have discriminated against immigrants from the Asian allies that are fighting on the side of the United States during this war. So in some ways, it's kind of a, you know, I don't know if you want to call it one step back, two step forward, one step back, or you know, sort of pros and cons. But given these sort of contrasting directions, how should we understand the overall legacy of World War II for anti-Asian racism in your view?
Yeah, and it's not just World War II. I think the chapter covers the Cold War as well, the early start of the Cold War. So it's war, not just World War II, because there's a real continuity, right, in terms of the exclusion debate from World War II through the Cold War, where a lot of the exclusionists, the diehard exclusionists like the AFL, switch sides. Or maybe switch sides is too strong a way of putting that. But they soften considerably on the exclusionist issue, where they're okay with the implementation of egalitarian policies, the end, basically, of Asian exclusion. Both these things are happening at the same time. My sense is that as bad as the internment of Japanese Americans was, I think it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of an exception to this overall trend that I noted starting from the 1930s, or at least the middle of the 1920s, of this sort of rise of egalitarianism. Now, certainly in the 30s and 20s, it doesn't succeed, as I say that very clearly in my chapter. But when you get to World War II, the egalitarianism does succeed in that exclusion ends. Chinese are allowed to immigrate. They're allowed to get a quota. So floods of Chinese are not coming in, but floods of all immigrants are not coming in because there's a quota in 1924, which for all nations in the world, larger for Western and Northern European countries, smaller for Southern and Eastern Europeans, and even smaller for Asian countries. But Chinese exclusion ends, and so they're on an equal footing in terms of the law, you know, to all of the other nations in terms of having a quota. By 1946, the In addition to the Chinese exclusion ended, which Franklin Roosevelt supported very strongly in 1943, Chinese are allowed, the immigrants in the U.S. are allowed to naturalize. Well, then the immigrants coming in, they're allowed to naturalize for the first time ever. And so no more alien land laws can apply to them because that applied to citizens not eligible for citizen or aliens not eligible to citizenship doesn't apply to the Chinese anymore if they naturalize. Or not even if they don't, right? Because they're eligible now to naturalization. Same thing happens with the Filipinos and Indians in 1946. They get a quota and they're allowed to naturalize. And then by 52, the same thing happens with the Japanese. And really, in theory, all Asians are allowed a quota and they're allowed to naturalize. And so it is a high point for egalitarianism. It's a reversion back to, in many ways, before 1882, when there was no differences in terms of how, you know, how the law, immigration law, applied to Asians versus how they applied to white. The caveat and the difference, the one sort of remaining problem for the Asians is the Asia-Pacific Triangle. There is this legal concept in immigration law that does discriminate against Asian immigrants as opposed to European or immigrants from any other part of the country. I won't get into it, but it's still an issue. But by 1965, that goes away as well. So the trend very much is toward egalitarianism. Now, I don't mean that, you know, everyone's not racist anymore in the U.S. You know, and everyone loves Asians and there are no problems. Not at all. But in terms of the law, in terms of the politics of the exclusion debate, there is a very noticeable swing in momentum toward the egalitarian side.
So that brings us to the final chapter, which is chapter 8, entitled After the Storm, Debating Asian Americans in the Egalitarian Era. And this is a, in some ways sort of sets up, I think, the historiographical purpose of the book, because you write about the transformation and in some ways the erasure of egalitarianism in the context of the Civil Rights Revolution and its aftermath. You write about the emergence of what you call an interpretive generation gap during this period, including scholars like Ron Takaki, who embrace a pluralistic vision rather than an assimilationist one, which we've seen before with folks like Robert Park. I found this one of the most nuanced sections of the book and therefore perhaps one of the trickiest to understand. And you explain that the point here for us to understand is that is not that Takaki's book, Strangers from a Different Shore, causes scholars to ignore the story of egalitarianism because you think that's too simplistic an explanation. So what would you like readers and listeners to take away from this final chapter? Or if I can ask the question differently, how do we honor previous egalitarians while pushing back against what is very clearly a history of discrimination and inequality when it comes to Asian migration in the United States?
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that. This is in some ways the hardest chapter to write because in many ways, it seems like it would lead itself to a kind of historiography, right, of everything written since the 1970s or something, since the emergence of ethnic studies. And I didn't want it to be that. I mean, clearly it's a part of this larger book, right? And so ultimately it had to just be the last chapter of this narrative. And I think what I ended up focusing on and what I was most curious about in terms of reading, you know, of thinking about the whole prospect of how do you narrativize the exclusion debate after the debate, after exclusion ends, right? So in 65, basically, there's no more exclusion, right? There's that last piece, the Asia-Pacific Triangle discrimination is gone. And there's not even different quotas anymore because people make that as a case for discrimination because Asians have much smaller quotas than, say, England. That's gone in 65. Every nation in the world has the same 20,000 quota, right? I mean, and we can get into some issues about, you know, Western Hemisphere and Eastern Hemisphere, but that doesn't really involve Asian countries and Asian peoples that much, or if at all. So really, the exclusion debate is over. And so how do I, should I just end it in 65? So I thought about doing that, but in many ways, the question came to me was not so much, you know, the exclusion debate, do we want Asians? Do we not want Asians? Do we discriminate against them or not? But it was really about, why don't we know about the exclusion debate? So really, this chapter is about memory and how historians, in this case, they're the main focus, but also congressional committees on redress and so forth, popular sort of these kinds of popular actions or public actions are important too, as in terms of, you know, the exclusion debate is over, but why don't we even know about an exclusion debate? Why is the sort of popular memory and scholarly memory of it that there was no debate? It was always about exclusionism. Maybe there are different types of exclusionism and different dimensions of exclusionism, but there was no egalitarian side. There was no real debate between that. And so that's how I read Takaki. That's how I read the redress debates and the congressional legislation, or not legislation, resolutions to oppose, apologize for, not an official apology, but what's the term, express regret for Chinese exclusion that Judy Chu, Congresswoman Judy Chu, was involved in. So that's how I bring a lot of that in, the Asian American movement, how I bring that in as well, and that literature of early ethnic studies, and how this whole notion of the debate just becomes impossible to recognize because of the ways in which Asian American history or the memory of Asian American history is shaped oftentimes for political reasons.
I think that's a really important point, especially in the current political environment where we have to recognize, because of the veracity of the debate, right, that the existence of that debate at least suggests the possibility of change making and resistance and pushback, and that there is an ability to build coalitions with certainly, you know, Asian American activists or activists within that community to speak up, as you have noted that people like Manuel Rojas do and others, but also to recruit, ally with, and collaborate with folks like William Seward, folks like Chester Roll after he, you know, is able to see the light, I suppose, and to bring them into that conversation as well on questions of inclusion for Asian Americans in the United States. Lon, I want to recognize that we've taken up so much of your time today, and I could talk to you, you know, two or three times longer about the book. But one of the things that I certainly want to recognize is that this is not even your most recent work that you've published. In the last year or two, you've actually published a textbook, I believe, called Global Americans, which we've also featured on the New Books Network, and more recently published an edited volume on sort of trans-Pacific histories of the United States. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how you see this work tying into both those books, but also the current research that you're doing, whatever that topic may be.
Yeah, so I had a lot of sort of balls in the air all at the same time, and they all, you know, I was editing three or four books all at the same time in page groups. So I was really busy a couple of years ago. I think that they all kind of merge in a way. And I usually see the Two Faces book as a kind of as the main text, because I mean, even though I devoted as much time and attention to all these other works, you know, this was this in some ways, you know, was more of my baby, because it was a single author monograph. And so I think Two Faces has a textbook feel to it, and that's intentional. I put all the pictures, the publisher wanted to put pictures next to the, you know, where the text talks about them. And I think that's the standard way of doing it. But I said, no, I want to put them all in the middle, gathered together, where I can write a lot of text, where students or anyone who wants to read the book quickly can just get like a PowerPoint, you know, pictorial sort of narrative of the whole book. And so if anyone is, you know, listening and they want just a quick summary of what the book, you know, what the narrative is, just go to the pictures, because that's the way it's intended. I think a lot of that came from my textbook writing, just thinking about how you can create summaries, create sort of handrails for readers to get through a lot of information quickly, or at least on the first pass, and then maybe go back and read it more carefully for the nuance and the detail. At the same time, you didn't mention this, but I had a second edition of my Major Problems textbook that I did with Alice Yang, Santa Cruz. And so we were thinking about, I was thinking about the textbook of all of U.S. history, but I was also thinking about sort of a textbook understanding of Asian American history. And there's so many changes that had gone on since we first published that, you know, 10 years before, or it was more than 10 years before. And so that was in this book as well. And then the Pacific America book, the edited collection with Hawaii, University of Hawaii Press, which has 15 essays about sort of trans-Pacific history. What is this whole new idea of globalizing Asian American history? That's in this book in terms of thinking about when I was talking about Sidney Gulick and missionaries expanding the narrative or expanding the scope of the narrative to include East Asia, right? To include what's happening over there, to including people going back and forth, et cetera, or consulates coming to the U.S., trade in Canton, et cetera, all of these types of thinking about globalization, you know, in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, in the late 20th century, you know, in historical context, and bringing that into the narrative of the exclusion debate, something that really hadn't included that in the literature before. So I think that's all tied in. What am I doing now? I've got a lot of things going on, but I think what I'll talk about is, going back to this quantitative side of me, is I'm interested in the kind of ethnic and racial history of California as an example of sort of a place where you have lots of Asians, but also you have lots of other immigrant and ethnic groups, and sort of thinking about the larger, how ethnicity plays a role in all of these groups, right? And how it shapes all these groups, and why is it that some groups get discriminated against and some groups don't? What impact does those discriminations have on the different, how can you follow that through the generations or through the, as well as the regions, what differences region make in terms of thinking about ethnicity. And the one thing I'm able to do, I'm using census data, is I'm able to look at European groups and not just to say, oh, Blacks, Asians, you know, and then different Asians and then different Latinos, but and then whites. But to break down the whites to Germans, Norwegians, you know, Poles, Hungarians, Jews are hard because they're all over the place. But in some sense, there is a variable in the census where it's language. So you can look at Hebrew, at least some of the Hebrew speaking Jews. But to be able to sort of chart maybe 20, 25 different ethnic groups and over time from the 19th century through the 20th century, and to look at sort of social trajectories, economic trajectories, segregation indices, to look at the impact of internment on the Japanese, ethnic economies, you know, and we think that ethnic economies, Chinatowns, Little Tokyos, were just unique, or agricultural for the Japanese, farming, were just unique to the Asians. And I think that's, you know, coming from Asian American studies, that's my knowledge base. But it's true for the Swedes. It's true for the Portuguese in particular, and in the East Bay and Northern California. And so I'm interested in doing kind of comparisons. How is it, you know, that how do these form? What do they do? Are there different sort of levels of discrimination that are faced? If so, why? And I should add one more thing. I'm interested in Hawaii too. So yes, California, but Hawaii too is another one of these multi-ethnic, multi-racial places that I don't think in either. I know in Hawaii there are social histories done of Hawaii, but there haven't been these types of comparative histories of ethnic groups. And in, like I said, in California, there are comparative histories of racial groups, but they don't break down the whites. And I think to compare both Hawaii and California, that's unique as well. I don't think there's been one study or a book-length study that's done both Hawaii in California in terms of multi-ethnic, not so much relations, but multi-ethnic histories and trajectories. So I'll stop there.
Well, that
Lon, that sounds like a great project, and I hope that maybe in the future we'll be able to get you back to talk about that. And certainly ties in nicely with, I think, the one of the key conclusions you make in at the end of Two Faces, which is to think about how Asian American issues connect with broader histories of public policies, and in this case, as you talk about with your future projects, social relations as well. So I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation and really enjoyed getting to read the book. Thank you so much again.
Great. Thanks, Ian.
That was my interview with Lon Kurashige, author of Two Faces of Exclusion, The Untold History of Anti-Asian Racism in the United States, published in 2016 by the University of North Carolina Press. I'm Ian Shin, and you've been listening to New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.